fasting. But whatever limit you reach, all right, here's what you've been waiting for. Take some of that money and set up an exacta bank. Set up a trifecta bank. But all the bets come out of that bank. If you set up an exacta bank, let's say you set $500 up. You're going to play 5% of that, $25. First thing, don't think that means, oh, I got to play 12 combinations. No. Make your exacta bets and then see how much money to put on each combination. If you're a three-horse box, you don't, and you're betting $30, you bet a $5 box. You don't go up and suddenly decide to make a six-horse box out of it. Keep your betting logical and reasonable. Keep an exacta bank, keep a trifecta bank, a pick-six bank, a twin tri bank, any bank you want. Place and show bank, any of that stuff. Whatever you want to keep, that's fine. Never add to any bank. You set it up and you start it. If it can't support itself, it dies. And it stays dead for a year. A year without exactas. Ah! But if you have just taken a $500 bank down to $36 in 4 weeks, you probably could use a year off from exactas. Particularly, and it'll become so logical, because you don't really care if you win exactas. You care about going from here to there. And you look down and you got a 236% return in 4 months. It win. You've taken the $200 bank up to $1,800. You set up an exacta bank and it's... What's the logical thing to do? You don't want to play exactas. You want to get to your goal. That's why goals are so important. And so you put aside the exactas. On the other hand, if your exacta bank, boom, explodes, you're starting hitting 30, 40, 50% of your exactas, your average mutual $76, you just can't get enough money through the windows. That's exactly what will happen. You'll start putting your money exactly where you want it, because you're betting a percentage. And the more money you have in the bank, the more money you bet. Pretty soon, when you hit an exacta, you have it 12, 15, 20 times. Even a small exact is fun if you got it 20 times. And the bank just explodes until finally you reach the sweaty palm or tote board limit. And then you set up another bank. How about place and show? Make a lot of money in the place and show pools. A lot of people ignore it. Sissy betting. Sissy betting. I'd rather wear a skirt than bet the show. It all spends, friends. Remember, nobody here, I want to make $25,000 a year, but not if I have to bet the show. No, I'll pass. No, not going to do it. That's not your goal, is it? I want to make X, but not betting the show? Did anyone write no show bets on their goal? No, the goal is to here to there. And you don't care how you make it, because this is what's important. The goal is what's important, not the process that gets you there. Record keeping, all of that stuff, is just the minutia that moves you to your goal. So whether you use this plan or another plan is unimportant. Have a plan, have a goal, and stride bravely into the future. Thank you.
Good job. Good job.
Proud of you, Dick. That's the first time Dick ever admitted that they paid off the place and show. He does very well with place. I have seen him lose the win bet but get a $12 place bet and have enough money on that to make a fortune. Yes, sir.
Can I ask a question to Dick?
Yeah, go over and ask him. You think I'm going to give him back the microphone? Ask the question, and then we'll get it answered for you. What is it?
I was curious what his guidance would be on triple betting with our methodology.
He bets triples very, very well and wins a lot of them. So does Hamilton and so does Brohammer. They bet them. They said they think they're the... Oh, he's going to answer it.
Triples are just like any other bet. You have a bank and you make it pay. If it doesn't pay, you don't make the bet. If you you want to do trifectas, right? You're talking trifectas or pick threes? Okay, either one. You set up a $500 bank, you say, I'm going to bet 5%. That's $25. That's where you start. If it goes up, you bet more. If it goes down, you stop betting.
Thank you, Dick. All right, folks, the next part of the seminar has proven since we started it in Saratoga 3 or 4 years ago, has always been the highlight. It's going to come as a kind of a blow to Hamilton and Schmidt because for the last two seminars we did on the road in San Francisco and in Seattle, they got to be the crossfire. But the original crossfire team, the first team, the stars, are Jim Bradshaw and Tom Brohammer. The reason for this is that in their approach to handicapping and in their approach to talking to people, they seem to be in great conflict. And therefore, we want to bring them together in that crossfire format right after you take a break, and we'll see if they're in conflict. I had to make the break official. They were going to take it anyway. Yes, sir. Good. They're going to... All right, are we ready? Gentlemen, will you... Mr. Cross and Mr. Fire, get yourself two chairs here.
Right.
Don't get too close to each other. You know how you are. Well, bring him to the mic. Let a hush follow over the room. My God, you guys are really big draws. There are even more empty chairs now than there were when I started.
Everybody's gone home.
How many of you newcomers have yet to read the Yellow Manual? Well, wonderful. I got a little something. I would suggest that you all, if you all those who did not read the Yellow Manual, have you read Tom Brohammer's book? Because Tom Brohammer's book is the first English translation of the Yellow Manual. But here's a fellow who has also read Tom Brohammer's book, but before he did it, he had to spend years with us, and he told me, he said, please don't use my name, but he said, you might be interested in knowing that you changed my life. I used to drink very heavily, but when I got the Yellow Manual, I realized I could never understand it with a hangover, so I stopped drinking, and as a result of stopped drinking, I understood the manual, and now I'm a winner. Thank you very much.
That's great.
Now, that's
great.
A true story, folks.
It is funny.
It's not, it's... I wish he hadn't given up drinking entirely. The only thing worse for being a drunk is being totally abstinent. Total abstinence has killed more people than alcoholism. Huh? But except unless you had a problem with it and you had to go total abstinent. But if you've never had the problem of alcoholism, you can just don't get the problem, but don't be abstinent unless you have to be. I'm not knocking those who had to take that course because of alcoholism, but okay, gentlemen, you have a little.
Yeah, is your middle name really Garland?
Yes.
I've known you for 10 years. I didn't know that.
Yeah, G stood for.
I'd keep using the G.
You thought the G stood for something else, huh?
I thought it was for Genevieve or something. Garland
stands for Guru.
Guru. Okay, that's better.
All right, gentlemen. This is the you've all seen crossfires on television, how many of you are aware that there's a great animosity and hatred between Bradshaw and Brohammer? Brohammer gets up and patiently tells people how to make a variant and how to do pars and everything. Bradshaw gets up and says, "I don't need no variant, no pars." And so it caused people to think that there was conflict. And then when we put them together, lo and behold, we found out what you're going to find out today. I want to start with this question. Does dosage have any value in handicapping? Go ahead, Tom. You know what dosage is. Jimmy doesn't.
Well, I haven't had a dose since I got married. No.
You think that's the way it starts? It's going to get better. Keep going. He's on a roll.
It's hard to deny the dosage statistics, but I don't pay any attention to them. I mean, I'll listen to them for the Kentucky Derby, and I'll get wrapped up in that, but I really don't pay any attention to them. Generally speaking, a horse going a mile and a quarter for the first time, if there's a number of them in the race, I don't bet the race anyway, so I don't care. Just too many things to hang up on. My bread and butter races are claiming races for the most part. I'd be delighted every day with 9 claiming races on the card. That's my ideal. I can't really help anybody in this respect. I mean, you cannot deny the statistics in the Kentucky Derby, and there was a lot of criticism last year when the status of Alidar was changed after Strike the Gold's win, but it was just an overdue change is all, so it doesn't really change that. Just no real comment on that. I just believe it works, but it's just not my bag.
I really thought when they talked about dosage is what we give the horses in Oklahoma to make them run fast.
Oh, maybe I misunderstood the question.
But, you know, we do a lot of that dosage up. Really, the dosage is basically the same thing as our sustained pace. You don't have to worry about dosage, just do sustained pace, especially on, say, longer races or races that are favoring more or less for sustained to win. And we're a step ahead of them because a horse that runs sustained has the dosage to run sustained.
Since Gato del Sol won the Kentucky Derby in 1982, we found, whether we were there to bet them or not, and mostly we were, that the top 2 sustained horses have won every Derby since I tracked it in 1982. Even Winning Colors was tied for 2nd in sustained because it had such a tremendous early. And 49er, who came in behind it by a nose, was the first sustained horse. Every year. The top 2 sustained horses this year were Pine Bluff and Lily T. They were so far over on the screen it was fun.
I guess you noticed that Strike the Gold didn't have the dosage to win the Kentucky Derby, but he had the sustained pace within the Sarton methodology to win the Kentucky Derby. After he won, now he's a high dosage horse.
That's right. They changed Alidar's status after that.
This is a good question because the phrase came up a lot during the week, and a lot of answers were supplied to it, but probably not a significant one. Now, the answer you'll get from this group will be the absolute answer. What's the best way, Tom and Jim, to recognize an improving horse?
Well, that's hard to say. There are many ways to recognize that whether a horse is going to improve or not. One is that here is a horse that likes to get the lead, and he was unable to get the lead. Today, he can get the lead and win the race. Now, to me, that's an improving horse. Or you've got a horse that was headed. I always look at horses that are headed. At any call, did this horse fight back or did he quit? See, a horse may not be improving as much as the conditions of the race favor him to improve today. A horse that is improving shows an improvement coming into his speed ratings. Declining horse is declining on his speed ratings. And that's basically the only thing that I can comment on.
Well, I would just add a couple. I mean, the horses that are carrying their speed further than they've been carrying it, for example, a horse that's been kind of folding up at the second call is now carrying it into the stretch. I look for, especially in sprints, I look for improved turn times. Especially if the horse is capable of going 22.3 or 22.4 around a turn and has not been doing that, and all of a sudden the horse goes 23.1, 23 flat, 22.4, that's an improving racehorse. And I'm especially tuned into that. But just small things like that. It's just a steadily progressive improvement in the figures as you look at it. You know, I mean, a horse runs 112, then he runs 111.3, then he runs 111.1. I mean, that's an improving racehorse. And all things being equal, you know, such as the racetrack being the same from time to time.
And positions.
Positions, yeah.
Well, is he improving his positions? Yeah. Position at the stretch, beating links at the stretch.
Yeah.
Any of these things.
Yeah, it's all relative to the times. You know, I mean, there's a lot to. I mean, it's very, very important, but it's really a hard one to answer in just a couple of minutes. But those are the things that I look for, especially.
I look at the pluses, all those pluses within and all, and mm-hmm. see what the cycle that they tell me is.
Yeah. Now, I do a little thing that I would suggest. I don't use the pluses and O's as such, but what I do with the racing form is that when I handicap a race, I just strike through. I just take a fairly bold marker so that I don't confuse what I've done and strike through the races that don't apply today. For example, if you have a horse that runs normally at 10 or 12.5 in sprints, and he's run a couple of routes in here and he's run a couple on the turf, what I'll do is I'll just strike through those all the way through the chart, and winding up with the only races remaining in that 10-race sequence are the races that actually apply to today's races.
Now that's a heck of a good idea. Why don't you use that at a seminar or something? You know, if you do that, folks, and ignore the ones you struck through, that last pace line that you call the last race may be four races back. Jimmy gave an example, but Tom endorsing what Jimmy did yesterday makes it even all the more sound.
Well, I didn't even see him do it.
That makes it even...
But I mean, honest. That really works, because all of a sudden you're focused in on the races. You know, I just do it automatically in just about every race, and you're just focused in on the races that apply. The races that don't apply, you don't care.
Very good. Okay, guys.
I would like to make one statement on the side. All right. This is in response to the 90 or 100 people that commented after Hamilton and Schmidt did their seminar yesterday, or their race yesterday. No, that race in 1990 is not the last race they won. They've won a few since then. They just chose one that wasn't current, that's all.
They want to make
sure. Unfortunately, I don't owe that to Hamilton, but I sure owe it to Schmidt after this morning.
Well, guys, how does tote board activity influence your bet, and if so, in what way?
Well, it does influence my bet, and it will tell me not to play. I mean, especially if I bet about one third of the time, I'll bet two horses, and the other two thirds of the time, I'll bet a single horse. And if the odds are such that I can't show a profit, or if I'm nibbling on such a small profit that I have to win too many races, I'll abandon the race. I mean, since a lot of you play enough to do that, you don't. Most of you don't, but I play full-time, so I can do it easily. But enough of you play often enough to be able to pass all the races you want, if that's the case, and still have another race coming in a half an hour in tomorrow and the next day. Now, weekend players, it's a little different. But I abandon it based on the tote board. And I also get a little more aggressive if the horse is up. You know, if I anticipate a horse being 3-1 and it's 5-1 on the board, and I can't find any reason for it to be 5-1 in my own handicapping, then I'll put a little bit more on it. But if my horse is being bet, I don't get overly encouraged about it, because I'm pretty sure that I've made basically the right call anyway. So I kind of hate to see everybody jump on it. So I'll abandon it if that's the case.
I basically do the same thing. It will influence my bet. If I'm betting a horse that's going off at, say, 7-5, all at once I look up there and he's 2-1, I'll go put more money on him. Or if I've got two horses, I'm not sure which one's going to win, they're both going off at 4-1, then I don't hesitate to bet two horses.
Absolutely. You can't bet two horses at 6-5, both of them. But 4-1, you sure can.
If I like one that's 1-2 and another one is 4-1, I normally would pass the race. So it does have an influence on what I do.
And I'll add just a little piece to that. If I have that same situation, 3-5 and 4-1, what I'll do is I'll just go ahead and put the same money I would have bet on the 4-1 originally and just abandon the other one and take my chances. Because if I was going to bet two in the first place, I have every right to believe that the other one will win just as quickly as the first one.
What's that thing Johnny Carson does, Carmack? Well, you give the. I'm going to give the answer, and anybody who can guess the question will give you a prize. The answer is, oh, yes, there is.
So, is there a Santa Claus at the races? Is that the...
No, that's pretty good. With Thoroughmation, there appears to be no track-to-track adjustments in some of the other programs. Why is this not needed? Well, the answer is, oh, yes, there is, and it's not needed because there is. Jimmy, explain that.
There is an adjustment. The adjustment that we showed yesterday... takes care of the daily variant, distance changes, and track to track. This is a triangular adjustment that is based on the energy of the horses that you have entered into the computer. It takes the dream race, takes the average of the horses that you put in, adds these together and gets another average, and then takes the difference between the horse's energy and this average and gives you a number. This is a velocity number, and it takes care of track to track or daily variant and or distance change. The only time that it doesn't is if you've got a horse coming from an extremely slow track to a, say, extremely fast track, and then it is recommended that you use the two adjustment. Many times it doesn't take into consideration a real fast sprinter going into a route, and you must use the two adjustment. But it does incorporate any time that you're using the total energy and an average of all of the horses in a race. Then one horse comes from Golden Gate, one horse comes from Hollywood, one horse comes from Belmont Park. You must be doing a track-to-track adjustment because you're adjusting it to the triangulated energy of all of the horses that are in the race on the surface that they're going to be running today.
Tom will pass on that one.
I'll pass on it. You wrote the program.
You use it.
Well, okay. Then I won't pass on it. Well, what I do with it from track to track is the first thing I use. That's the reason I keep the $10,000 pars at all the tracks. And if I have a difference in the track, for example, Golden Gate and I was talking about it yesterday, Golden Gate and Hollywood Park. Golden Gate's about four lengths faster at a mile 16th. Well, what I'll do is I'll adjust that Golden Gate line, and then it's for all intents and purposes, after I've done that, the computer then assumes they're both on the same racetrack. Because if I've made that basic adjustment, then I let the computer take care of the daily part of it. Okay, so I do it that way rather than have to go to the two adjustment.
But if you read the manual, you'll notice that Tom got the winner, the place, and the show horse doing it that way, and doing just the way that Jimmy's talking about, sure. Got the winner, place, and the show horse. So.
Yeah, we're not very far apart. I mean, in the Kentucky Derby, both Jimmy and I thought Pine Bluff was the right horse. In the Preakness, we both thought Pine Bluff was the right horse, and yesterday we both thought AP Indy was the right horse. So we come kind of from different points of view, but we wound up with the same horse in all three of those races in the Triple Crown. And we did, I think, last year also. So we're not all that far apart. We just come at it from a different direction.
So whichever you feel the most comfortable with, you want to do that like Tom does, and that makes you feel secure and gives you confidence, by all means, do it. I couldn't do it, so I do the automatic. I really could never do it, Tom. That's why I admire him so. That's why he always sits right over here near me. I do admire what Tom... I really do. I do admire
right
what
at his
Tom.
Knee. Look at this.
I admire
there's something
him,
in
and,
this.
But I can't duplicate him. And if you can't duplicate him, just admire him and do it the way that wins, because Tom is a unique individual. Well, this Jimmy will love this one. Is APV always determined using the horse's entire career? Should it be linked to the past 1 or 2 years in some circumstances? You're the APV man, Jimmy.
Well, not really an APV.
Really?
I don't run APV. Now, I'm not saying that for you not to run it. And it doesn't mean that I don't look at the money that a horse has won. But I don't have to run the APV to know that a horse can win, has been able to win. And I don't want anything to throw me off of a horse. If I've got a horse and he's got a real low APV and I've got horses that's won a lot of money, this may be the day that this horse wins and wins a lot of money. And this is the time that I want it. I don't knock APV, but I just don't use it because I don't feel that I have to. But I suggest that if it helps you get contenders or helps you in to go back on a horse, I go back wherever I want to, and I don't need APV to tell me that, say, you can go down 5 lines on this horse. Look at Chigger Choice. I went down because I wanted to. And this is just some of the things that I do. So I'm sorry I can't help you, but I suggest that you do it.
If you read Tom's biography, written in Dick Mitchell's Thoroughbred Handicapping as a Profession, or whatever it is, he starts off by telling the world that Tom Rohammer was able to win with anything. In fact, he used the Kelco Class Calculator, which is an APV program, and won long before he ever met Sarton. So Tom is probably the world's foremost user of APV. Tom, would you tell us about the answer to that question?
That is really cold. The way I used it at that time, I mean, it's still in the earlier stages, and I just put the average purse value on the horse and then handicapped the horse around that, and abandoned, I'm using that word a lot today, just moving from the top horse to the second horse to the third horse based on the handicapping of the race, and often I'd bet the third horse. So that was just a starting place for figures before I discovered figures per se. Average purse value, I make a class evaluation on every race, on every horse. And I just do it differently. When I was talking about drawing lines through races don't apply, you're basically doing that. Because when you're finished, you have the horse's performance at the level you're looking at. That's basically APV. I was looking. Now, I didn't run. I would be curious. The Chigger's Chance, is that the name of the horse?
Yeah.
I think if you did a pretty thorough class evaluation on that race, the Chigger's Chance would be a high-class horse in that field.
Yes.
Based on where he had won compared to Tolvia or whatever the other horse who had been down at 4,000 and 5,000. Chigger's Chance, without running APV, while Jim was doing that race, I was looking at the race itself, and I would have considered him to be the high-class horse of the three contenders. Anyway,
which was
basically APV. I mean, it's just a different way of doing it, that's all.
Yep.
And I've always said I just don't use APV, but I guess I use it in a little different format. I just don't do any numbers with it.
He's 143% of purse on the turf and by far the highest in the race.
Okay. I just assumed that when I was looking at where he had won and where he had competed.
Well, you know, I saw the amount of money that he won was more than any of the other horses, so, you know, he has to have a higher APV. So maybe in a sense I do like Tom does. I don't do the APV per se, but I do evaluate the horse and what he's capable of doing.
Mostly, Steve, when you look at a racing form for a number of years and you've seen what's there, a lot of people look at it and they don't see anything, but when you see what's there, you pretty well know APV in class automatically without running it through. Okay, gentlemen, here you go. This is a good mainstream question. If you have a horse, either looks bad on the track or has first-time front wraps, does that affect your wagers?
I'll start it. If I have a pretty good memory at the racetrack, so I remember most of the horses from having seen them before, and when a horse comes onto the racetrack with front wraps for the first time, I really do get excited about that. As far as the appearance of the horse, there's a horse called Island Jamboree. I was at the racetrack with James Quinn and with another friend, and Island Jamboree was my selection in the race. And this horse came on the racetrack looking like they had hosed it with a fire extinguisher. And Jim decided not to make the play, and I cut my play in half. And the horse paid 29. Now, that's the kind of judge of appearance that I am. So I don't do that. I mean, unless the horse is acting up so bad that I don't want any part of it, I just have to assume that the handicapping was right. I'm just not good with it visually. I mean, some people are. Unless the horse is just out of hand, acting up, wants to break through the gate, that kind of thing, I'll just kind of stay with it and bite the bullet.
Basically the same thing. Very seldom do I look at the horses. You know, I get so aggravated in Las Vegas that they want to show the post parade and show the horses more than they want to show the tote board. I'm wanting to watch the tote board and not the horses. I wouldn't know whether he had worn bandages or wraps before, or this is, or not. I wouldn't know whether he was hurt or limping or not. I don't watch them that closely. And besides that, I don't trust trainers. They gamble. And if they think, if they're wanting the high odds, they wrap that horse. They don't. This is true.
Hey, limp, Charlie. We want to get the odds up. Yeah, that's not a part of the methodology. I'm sure a lot of people subconsciously look at them. Some of them do. I saw a horse with kidney. I didn't know what it was. I thought he was painted white on his underside. And somebody said, "Boy, that horse has got kidney swiss." I said, "Is that what that is?" And I wasn't going to bet him. We knew who the winner was, but it was a big exacta potential. And at the last minute, I said to myself, "You don't know anything about this, you dummy. You're not an expert at this." And I ran up and just got to the window in time to get him a place bet in the exacta. And he comes in, he pays $12 a place, and keys a exacta with a horse that was pretty much slated to win. So
yeah.
unless you know this stuff, as he does in many instances because he memorizes, unless you know, don't be guessing about body language.
Yeah. Unless you're Trillis Parker or Joe Takish or somebody that does have those visual skills, you just be careful with it.
This is
and then if you do have them, apply it by all means.
Yeah. This is an easy question, and I think it stems from somebody who read Tom Brohammer's book and someone has seen something subsequent to it. At one time, it wants to know what the difference between par median and par early is. They are the same. They represent a horse's energy to the second call. The par early was an arbitrary formula I devised, and the par median is an actual formula. So the par early was an old-fashioned formula that was manufactured, whereas par median is the actual amount of percentage that the horse expended to the second call. The reason that Tom used percentage early is, well, we said, don't give away all our secrets, Tom, or people won't like you. In the methodology, they will think you are telling the public everything we know. So he held back and used only par early. Anybody want to comment further on that?
No, and just that, in my own case, I've just looked at early energy for so long, and it works so well for me that it's one of those, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know. Well, now the programs have all got median energy. So.
No comment.
The par median is superior for use because the parameters are narrower. But Tom was able to look at 51 and 54 and be able to distinguish, whereas most people said, well, that's too wide of a gap for me to determine. So with the par median, your gaps are much smaller. And Spencer did a study for us, and that's why we changed the median. All right, here's one. They want to start an argument here. Let's get an argument going. Tom, you appear really to rely heavily on the track model. How do you then reason for the mix and match up of the horses? In other words, the energy matchup. This is from an esoteric smart guy, so give him a good esoteric smart answer.
I want to formulate the answer because I don't want to misstate this. Within certain, well, like at Hollywood Park right now, I gave you what is winning at 6 furlongs. It's early and it's pressers. I will still, but there are a couple of closers that won in that model sample. If the race is predominantly early, the horses that are contending are early, I'll look away from that. I'll look for the presser, which is the very next piece in the sequence. And if the pressers are not sharp, I'll go to the closer because of the matchup of the race. On the other hand, I began that whole sequence by preferring the early and the presser. And if there's a presser that's sharp in that race against all the early, I'll go for the presser. Doesn't change the matchup of the race. I mean, the matchup of the race still dictates who's going to win it. But within certain parameters, pressers and early are winning at Hollywood Park, so that's where I look first. Then if the matchup tells me that I'm looking in the wrong area, I'll go elsewhere. I think it's just a matter of sense here. I'm just not so stubborn. Just because it's an early track, I'll bet a field of all of 8 horses, it can go 21-3, 44-2, all of them. I'm not going to try to separate those horses. I'm going to look for the horse that's going to pick them all up, even if it's an early racetrack. I think that's the only way I can state it, but I do spend a lot of time with the profile. You know that. I've shown you that. But that just tells me where I'm going to start. Generally, that's where I end also, but not always. The matchup of the race is what dictates that.
The mix and matchup, the energy matchup of the race of, because of the horses themselves. How do you then reason for the track model?
Well, I think that what Tom said really truly applies. It applies what he does. You know, he keeps a model, but if he knows that the matchup of the race is going to predict something else, he will eliminate the model. You know, I will do the watching the races. I've got horses, and this is an early track. And I see that horses are not going to hold on early, or that they can't hold on due to the mud or many other things. This may be a model for that particular day, or it may be the horses in the race that are running early have bad third fractions. I think that if you know these things, that it will help you. If what Tom told you, that it is early or early pressers are winning, then that predominantly at Hollywood Park, then you're going to win more races by keeping a model. Tom is versatile enough that he can switch from model to what he believes in the matchup. So, you know, if Tom can switch from a model to the matchup, then why should I keep a model if I'm going to model a matchup?
You guys want to pick out the furniture in the morning?
No, one last comment. I gave you the statistics at Hollywood Park in two turn races. I think there were 32 two turn races and two horses have gone wire to wire. But I mean, I'm going to have to like a horse on the lead a lot because there's been a lot of lone F type horses in that whole sequence that haven't survived. And yet, I'm seriously considering betting a horse to go wire to wire today, just because of the way the race shapes up. I may or may not make that play just because it's unsafe ground. But the matchup says that the horse has got a very big chance to go wire to wire. But you can't argue with the stats. I mean, you know, when you there are a lot of races there, and there are a lot of front running types that have gotten clear and can't make it. So, you know, it's pretty hard to go against that here. Most of the time, the racetracks are reasonably fair. And then you just play it based on who you think is going to be in front or in the middle or behind and what comes up.
What I found is that the matchup and the model are so frequently in agreement. The only time I've ever found when they're not in agreement, this is a properly kept model with logical people in it. About 20% of the time you'll get such an overwhelming bias that it dominates everything. But it's only 20% of the time, and it strikes and it goes away just as rapidly. Now, Tom told me and capitulated with my opinion, which I got from a different angle, that pressers and sustained pressers were winning all the races at a given track during a given period at 6.5 furlongs. And yet Tom knows some of the great mainstream experts who insist that all tracks run early. And they were losing, and Tom was winning, and I was winning, and I couldn't understand why these people persisted in betting early. Now, those are the kinds of people you want to avoid being. Don't get a model fixed in your mind that this track is running early or this distance is running sustained or something, and then think that model lasts forever. I think that's the warning that Tom has given more than anything else, so you might want to reiterate it. Yesterday's model is not necessarily tomorrow's.
No. I just say yes to that. No.
Good. That's very good.
You know what reiterate means?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Certainly. Let me give one more, make one more comment. The race that Howard showed you from the fairgrounds, that Choo Choo, Real Choo Choo won, the race right before that, now this track had started drying out. The race right before that runs sustained. Now, people didn't want to believe Howard and myself that Real Choo Choo would win because he couldn't hold on because the track had changed. The track hadn't changed. The makeup of the horses had changed in the race before to where early could not win. And in this race, we've got a lone early that can win. So, you know, here's where a model would cost you a $20 winner. Or if you perceive a model or perceive a track change. So make sure that this track has really, really something has happened before you switch. You know, Tom's not going to bet a early horse if he knows sustained's going to win the race. Regardless of what his model says, you've got to be flexible enough to do that also.
Yeah, that 10th and 11th race at the Emmanuel for New Orleans is a good example. The 10th race was the only race of the day to run sustained, and everybody ran down and told Jimmy, because, hey, Jimmy, the track's changing. And Jimmy said, no, it ain't. He said, you had a lot of early horses in that race, and they burned each other out. That's the only reason it appeared to be sustained. And a lot of them didn't believe him, and then they bet the next race wrong.
So and I hit the sustained horse also.
Sure.
And they left the track. I knew when the track was going to change.
One gentleman, Dick Schmidt, made an impression on him. He wanted to let us know his goal. His goal is to retire at the end of 1993, to use handicapping to augment that retirement income and still have time and money to see Alaska, Austin, and other places. Very good goal. If all of you could write down your goal and then take and keep it in your mind and then let us know next time if you achieved it. Crossfire, how do you arrive at the projected pace of a race? Second part of the question, when can a contender be off slower 4/5 of a second or more and still be accepted as a contender? I think they're talking about the second call, the off at the second call. And this is meat for Jimmy because this is where people misunderstand the whole match up in projected time?
In all reality, I don't project what today's time is going to be. It's hard enough to project what these horses can possibly run. You can look at a race and say, okay, here's a horse in this race that needs 22 to win the race. Of all of the other horses in this race, can he get 22? Now, this doesn't mean that this race is going to run in 22. What you're setting up is an establishing what does a horse need to be able to get a particular lead. Now, if he gets it on a 22, what does he need at the second call? Can he maintain this? Say, if he needs a 45 and there's another horse that runs a 44-4. Well, this horse isn't going to get it, so evidently we've got other horses and other things that we've got to look at. I don't think that it's possible to just set up and say this horse, this race is going to run in 22-45-110 with the makeup of the horses in the race. And this is one of the reasons. It was about a year and a half or maybe 2 years I stopped teaching the matchup. I just stopped teaching it because everyone became experts on the matchup and wanted to put their computers away. They perceived that I said this when I didn't say that.
And they ended the race at the second call, too.
And they ended the race there. And you must take the race from the first call to the end of the race. You know, race doesn't stop at the, nor does it start at the second call. You know, all races I've been to, it starts when the gate opens, and it finishes when the photo goes up to knock me out of my second place horse. You know, I'm sitting there yesterday. I've got AP Indian. I've got Strike the Goat. What's his name?
Pine Bluff.
I've got it. They come in here, and they got 20 yards to go, and I know I've got a $20 exact to hit. I know it. Hey, I'm ready to just go to the window. I told my wife, go to the window. We got this one.
I thought I had the trifecta, too.
So here he goes. Here comes this horse and slips in.
Little foreign horse.
We're sitting down, and a foreign horse. You know, I don't can't even pronounce it.
I don't like foreigners in Oklahoma.
Darn foreigners.
I said, and here we got, we're sitting down at Sahara. And I tell Howard 5 or 6 times in a row. 5 or 6 times. I said, look here, Howard, I got this race. I got it. There's my winner and my place horse. 3 or 4 yards to go. 3 or 4 yards. Now, this is true.
Yeah, I was there, folks.
Howard laughs at me. Here comes some horse from one of these ugly, ugly, ugly horses. And slipped between my two horses. Howard just laughed. He said,
he's got a pile of tickets for
him. Yeah, here, first and third right here. I'm just sitting there. 5 times in a row this happens to me. You know, I've got it won. There's not another horse in sight. They got daylight. I say, hey, I've got it won here this far to the finish line.
And we're asking you questions?
And here comes this ugly, ugly thing. Now, I got my winner bet.
Yeah, it's easy to win, folks. Don't tell me.
Here's another expert on body language. That horse was ugly. No, is he washy or is he, what is he?
Ugly.
Ugly.
Do you remember the question, Tom?
The question?
Yeah, you were asked. I asked a question that had to do with, can a horse be 4/5 of a second off or more and still be accepted as a contender? And I think they mean at the second call. Yes.
Well, yeah, of course, because some of these races just collapse up on the front end. You know, I mean, if the second call, the horse is 4 lengths off the projected pace, and you have to be within 2, and there ain't anybody else in between that horse and the leaders, the horse is certainly a contender, because if the pace collapses, he'll pick it up. If the horse is 4 or 5 lengths off the par of the race and the final, you know, because I don't project the race either in terms of each one of the fractions, because a lot will depend. I mean, you look at that race yesterday at Hollywood Park, the 7th race, you...